The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Before we chat with my pal Frank Isola, I want to let you know that today's show, as always, is brought to you by Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. And welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. Frank Isola is one of my favorite people in the newspaper business and would be even if we hadn't been colleagues at the Daily News since 1994. For those of you outside New York, I don't know if you fully appreciate that covering the Knicks for Frank is like being embedded behind enemy lines. The Knicks don't like him. They don't like me. They don't like our newspaper. But Frankie's the one who's been in the barrel for a very long time and still continued to cover the team splendidly. He is a columnist. He is one of the wired-in guys in the NBA. You now see him on ESPN, on Around the Horn, and we're lucky to have him sometimes on the Sports Reporters. And why is he on the Sports Reporters? Because Mr. Lupica thinks he's great on the show. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Mike, how you doing? What an introduction. That might be the whole podcast.
Frankie, when would you say that your relationship with the people at the Garden began to sour? And by the way, when I say people at the Garden, I mean the people in charge, because you had a terrific professional working relationship with Jeff Van Gundy. You, like me, loved and got along with Patrick Ewing. You've always been someone who had great sources in the locker room. So it has nothing to do with the team or even the coaches. But when did management start to turn on you?
I think really when they started to lose a lot, and maybe a lot of it happened after Larry Brown was there that year, which, you know, they didn't give Larry the right amount of time. Larry Brown's going to come in. He's going to try to build a culture and do things his way. And they ran Larry Brown out, and I think they started to pick sides. Well, you're either with us or against us. And it's funny what you mentioned. You know, I think now when you think about what's going on in politics and with the White House, it to me, when I hear some of these stories coming out of this, it sounds very similar. When there's a story that they don't like, well, that's made up. That's not true. The media's just out to get us. And that wasn't the case at all. Because I think, Mike, if you go back to, you know, when the Knicks were very good in the 90s, especially that year in 99, 2000, back-to-back conference finals, you know, we weren't cheerleaders for the team, but, you know, we were enjoying it and we were covering the team the way it deserved to be covered. They were playing well. They were playing great games, and the coverage reflected that. I say it all the time. We do not dictate the coverage. The results dictate the coverage. And, Mike, all we have to do is look at their record the last 17 years. Why would the coverage be good when, except for a couple of seasons here or there, the year with Mike Woodson when they won the 54 games, you know, for the most part, it has not been good. So obviously, and rightfully so, the coverage is going to reflect that.
You know, Frank, I think people outside of New York don't fully appreciate what a dumpster fire this really has been. That the New York Knicks, who, you know, they've only won two championships, but they have been one of the iconic teams in the league. And they certainly produced one of the most beloved teams in the history of the sport with Clyde and Willis and Bill Bradley and Dave DeBuscher, have won one playoff series, one in the last 17 years. And in that time, only the Minnesota Timberwolves have lost more basketball games than they have.
You know, I know you feel the same way I do about a guy like Patrick Ewing, and I know you have a very good relationship with him. I like Patrick a lot. And every time I see him, and we were obviously very fair to Patrick, and, you know, for the most part, I think he got great coverage. But every time I see him, I almost feel like apologizing to him. Because it's almost like, Patrick, when you were there, we treated it like it's either championship or bust. And now think about what's gone on there. Except for really that one year with Mike Woodson, when they had a great season. And you know what? If things had broken right and maybe guys didn't get injured, they could have made the conference finals and really, I think, giving Miami a run for their money because they had played very well against them during the regular season. But it's amazing how much things have changed, and we know how it works. When you're changing general managers all the time, and you're changing head coaches all the time, and then you start changing the roster over and over, the only thing that is consistent is the losing. And to me, I thought they had something. They lucked into kind of Jeff Van Gundy. They promoted him from an assistant coach, and they ended up doing the same thing with Mike Woodson. And isn't it interesting that instead of going on some crazy long coaching search, it was a guy that was on your own bench that you had promoted. And Jeff, I thought, had very good success, and I thought Mike Woodson, compared to what's gone on in the last 17 years, maybe they should give Mike Woodson a plaque. And I felt like they had something good there. So that's the other thing that frustrates you, because you had Steve Clifford on that staff. You had Michael Malone on a staff. You had Tom Thibodeau. You had Mike Woodson there. And you kind of let these really good, talented guys, Kenny Atkinson, go away. So it's almost like when the Knicks have something good, it's almost like they don't realize it until it is way too late.
We're talking to my pal Frank Isola from the New York Daily News and ESPN. Frankie, what is extraordinary to me, considering how much Phil Jackson, whether directly or indirectly, has blamed the Knicks' current circumstances on Carmelo Anthony. And, I shared this number with you a couple of weeks ago, and it only gets better and better. Since Phil Jackson took over, and we'll even give him the 10-5 that Woody put up at the end of the season after Phil was announced. Okay, we'll give him that. Is 74 games under 500 with the Knicks. The 3 years before that, Carmelo and the Knicks were 27 games over 500. So, Frank, here's my question to you. If everything is Carmelo's fault, how'd they win all those basketball games?
And the thing, too, is we know that Phil wants to be judged on his record because he wrote a book called 11 Rings. So if all that matters to you is the record, he needs to own this record and stop assigning blame, especially to a guy like Carmelo. Now, is Carmelo the perfect player? You and I both know that he isn't. But they seem to have something working that year with Mike Woodson when they won the 54 games, and Carmelo finished third in the MVP voting, and he's also playing power forward, which creates all kinds of matchup problems. And I think when Phil came in there, Phil had every chance to look at Carmelo Anthony and say, you know what, I know you're being recruited by these other teams, the Lakers are looking at you, the Chicago Bulls, you know what, we're going to move in a different direction. That's not what he did. In fact, he started calling him out publicly. Well, he needs to take less money. If he comes back, great. If not, that's great. Next thing you knew, they were out in L.A., and he was giving Carmelo a max contract, and Carmelo said, you know what, I want a no-trade clause. He did not put a gun to Phil Jackson's head. Phil Jackson gave him the no-trade clause. Now, you want to say that was Jim Dolan? Go right ahead. But the bottom line is, it's Phil Jackson. And, he's the one running the show. That's all we ever hear now at the Garden. This is Phil Jackson's deal. So anything that's gone on with Carmelo in terms of the contract, the no-trade clause, that is on him. And has Carmelo slowed down a little bit? Yes. Is he the perfect player? I just said that. He's not. But you've also given him four coaches in the last 4 years. So the continuity that you promised, you failed on that end. That has not happened. You failed Carmelo Anthony a lot more than he's failed you. And, Mike, you and I have talked about this before. When they hired Phil Jackson, he was a neophyte at the job because he's never done it before. The one guy who had a proven track record in his area of expertise was Carmelo Anthony. And all this time later, we know what Carmelo Anthony is. We still don't know what Phil Jackson is as an executive.
Frankie, you've been on social media a lot this week talking about how little scouting Phil Jackson does. And tell me about this triangle clinic that you've been tweeting about over the last 24 hours. Because if there's that kind of clinic, is that like the Mayo Clinic where you, if you're suffering from delusions about the triangle offense, is it like the Mayo Clinic where you can go and get help?
Well, your good friend, Larry Brown, said about 10 days ago, or maybe it was a week ago, the idea that, that's great if Phil Jackson wants to run the triangle. He's the best at it. You then coach the team. And I think what Phil Jackson is doing, it's very, to me, if I'm a player, if I'm a fan, if I'm working in the organization, you have to be discouraged by what's going on. The Knicks had played a game the other night on the road in Milwaukee and lost the game. The next morning, a handful of players, including Derrick Rose, were asked to come up to practice early, and Phil Jackson was running kind of like a mini triangle clinic and talking to the players about the triangle. And
sure,
he's running it. So if you're Jeff Hornacek, how are you not sitting around thinking, what's going on here? How is that going to make Jeff Hornacek look in the locker room that the president of the team is running some kind of clinic, and it's an offense that we know that Jeff Hornacek doesn't want to run? Do you think Pat Riley is doing that in Miami? Or better yet, Mike, what would Phil Jackson's reaction have been if Jerry Krause or Jerry West had done that when he was coaching either the Bulls or the Lakers? Do you think Phil Jackson would have stood for that? And that to me is the part where I just can't, you know, get past. I mean, Phil, you were a coach. You know how hard it is. You need to give these coaches that you hire a bit of a break. Let them run the team the way that they want to run it. You go out and get the players. But that's the problem over at the Garden. There's not enough defined roles. Everyone's trying to do a different type of job. Just focus on the job that you were hired to do.
We're talking to Frank Isola, the New York Daily News and ESPN. Frankie, the day Phil was introduced, and I have to look at the exact date, but I think we've moved up on a magical third-year anniversary of that moment, okay? One of the things he promised was a culture change at Madison Square Garden, which to me meant an openness with the media that had been missing in all the Politburo days of Dolan's Garden. And Frank, you can't find the guy. Is there a more distant and loopy executive in this league than the Zen Master?
And what really bothers me, too, is you hear this, you know, from people in the organization. Sometimes you hear it from some fans, not the smart fans that get it. Oh, you guys just don't like Phil because he doesn't talk to you. I don't care if he doesn't talk to me. He needs to be talking to the fans. That's who you owe it to. You need to lay out what your plan is. But obviously, he doesn't have the answers. That's why he doesn't want to do it. Now, we know what happened in February with Charles Oakley and that ugly scene at Madison Square Garden. And next thing you know, Jim Dolan made himself available. Jim Dolan has not been available to talk about the Knicks for 3 years. Phil Jackson has not spoken about the Knicks since September. Yet something as silly as this Charles Oakley thing, they felt they needed to come out and explain it and get out their side of the story and spin it. And I don't know about you, but to me, that kind of comes across as the basketball part about it. We don't really care about that. We care about this other nonsense that's going on. That we'll talk about. That will spin in the public and try to win this silly thing in the court of public opinion. Because guess what, Mike? There's really no keeping score in the court of public opinion. The issue that they have is that the NBA requires that you keep score during the games, and that you then keep a record of the games. And we know that there's really nothing they could say about that, but they need to come out and say something. Go back to the Derrick Rose when he went AWOL. You are the president of the team. This is a situation where a guy that you brought in, who's a former MVP in the league, just got up and left. You guys didn't even know where he was. God forbid. They sent someone to his apartment. That's how worried they were, and rightfully so. And the Knicks did nothing wrong in this situation. In fact, I think the only thing the Knicks did wrong, I think they should have suspended him for one game. But Phil Jackson had an obligation there not to make his coach sit and explain the punishment. That should have been his job. And when you're not doing that, it really makes you start to wonder, is he fully committed to this job? I don't think he wants any part of it. I think all he wants is the triangle part. That's what he knows. So, Mike, you brought up the word culture. I think for Phil Jackson, I think the culture is the triangle. That's all, because that's all he knows.
We're talking to Frank Isola, the New York Daily News and ESPN. Frank, his obsession with it has gone beyond anything that you could even attach common sense to. Okay, and I actually was watching a game the other night, and the young woman's name escapes me, the sideline reporter now from Madison Square Garden,
Rebecca
and
Harlow.
She does a terrific job. This is nothing against her, but I'll tell you want to talk about culture? She's actually talking on the broadcast about how Chasen Randall is the kid from Stanford.
Yep.
Is a good fit for the Knicks because he played the triangle for Johnny Dawkins. You can't make this up, Frank. For Johnny Dawkins at Stanford, who, by the way, no longer coaches Stanford.
it scares you. It really does. And I think when you look at the way the NBA is going and the way that teams are adjusting, and look no further than two guys that you know that Phil Jackson measures himself against as a GM and probably as a coach, Greg Popovich and Pat Riley. They change with the times. They have a certain way of doing something, yes. They try to build the culture, but they're open to changing. Pat Riley was the coach at the Showtime Lakers. He came to the Knicks. He looked at his roster and said, you know what, we're going to have to beat everybody up. Then he went to Miami and thought the same thing. And then he went out and got more skilled players when he got very lucky with LeBron. And obviously he drafted Wade. They got Chris Bosh to come there. And they changed the way they played. Look at the way Greg Popovich has done it in San Antonio. They went from being a team that just pounded it inside to David Robinson and to Tim Duncan. They've changed the way that they've played. So you have to adapt with the system. It's not about proving that the triangle works. We know the triangle works. It worked in Chicago. It worked in L.A. But at least acknowledge the fact that in Chicago, you had the greatest player, in my opinion, in the history of the game, in L.A. with Scottie Pippen. And then you also had Shaq and Kobe in L.A. Don't think it was the offense. It was those great players. Because how many times late in the game were they running? Did you think when the Bulls had the ball late in the game, were they running the triangle or were they running get the ball to number 23, get out of his way, and something magical is going to happen?
Frank, by the way, when the sides were remotely even, okay, when they were remotely even with Larry Brown against Phil Jackson that year that Larry won with the Pistons, he deconstructed that offense.
Yes, he absolutely did. And I think for Phil, that was probably his worst moment, or I should say most disappointing moment as a coach, because you know they kind of put that team together with Gary Payton and with Karl Malone, and that was going to be the team that everybody thought. Remember, some people thought they might go undefeated throughout the entire playoffs, and obviously they had some bumps along the road, but that was a great win for Detroit, and Larry really coached them that year. And, you know, once again, we're talking about Phil as a coach, and I think as a coach, we know what a great job that he's done, but as an executive, it's almost like he doesn't want to do that job. He wants to kind of be the coach and do it from the 10th row, and doing it that way just doesn't work. And you mentioned, as he's running this triangle clinic, you have the ACC tournament in Brooklyn, and you have the Big East tournament at Madison Square Garden. That's his backyard. That should be what he's focused on. Bob Myers was not at the Boston Celtic Golden State Warrior game the other night in Oakland. He's out scouting. That's a guy whose team won 73 games the year before and has been to back-to-back NBA finals. You know, it's like that's what the job is. And if you didn't want that part of the job, maybe you shouldn't have taken all that money.
We're talking to Frank. I saw Frankie, you know, and here's another thing. And again, you know, I've been joking with you, and I think I put it in a column the other day. I sometimes watch the post-game press conferences with Hornacek, and I believe he's blinking out a distress code. I can't prove that, okay? But Frank, Jeff Hornacek, and look at the end of the star search for Phil Jackson with coaches. Derek Fisher, who had as much coaching experience as you and me. Start there, okay? Then he was as obsessed with Kurt Rambis as he is with the triangle offense, and he didn't have the guts to make him the head coach. And now he gets Jeff Hornacek, who's a very nice guy. But Frank, look at the season that the Knicks have played. Look at the season. How many games have they lost in the last 15 or 20 seconds this season?
I thought that Jeff Hornacek would get overwhelmed from this standpoint. You know, he had a bit of an ugly ending in Phoenix, a fallout with a couple of players, and he's a very nice man. But I think where he lost it right away was when he came to New York and he inherited Kurt Rambis as his assistant coach. I think with the play, listen, do I have a problem with it? You can name whoever you want as your assistant coach. But I think he lost the players at that point because I think the players were looking at it, well, hang on a second, you're coming in as a head coach and you're going to hire the guy who finished second for the head coaching job, how is that going to work? And we all know that that's Phil Jackson's guy. And I think that's a big problem that Phil made. And Phil, he just doesn't know enough people. I mean, think about the people that you know around the NBA, starting with a guy like Larry Brown. Larry knows everybody. What was Larry doing when he's the coach of the Knicks? All he was doing was calling other GMs. They're his friends. This is what Larry does. He talks basketball all the time. Phil doesn't have that kind of relationship. And when trades happen, how often are they happening with guys who've worked together or have a connection, whether it's through USA Basketball or the San Antonio Spurs? You know, it's a relationship kind of business, and I think that's what really hurt Phil. And he really didn't want to interview anybody. It's almost like the Knicks were kind of, you know, prodding him along. Come on, go talk to Frank Vogel. go talk to Jeff Hornacek. He really want that part of it. He doesn't feel comfortable in those types of settings, which once again makes it an odd choice that he's the guy. I still go back to, there were people in L.A. that year when we knew that the Knicks were talking to Phil, where people said Phil wants to be a consultant. He wants to make about $2 to $3 million a year, which is nice of him, being basically a guy that hangs out in L.A. He'll come to New York every once in a while, you know, for a couple of meetings. He'll meet up with the team on the West Coast. I just don't think he had the energy. I don't think he had the drive, the appetite, the know-how to really want to do the job full-time. And I think the Knicks blew him away with an offer because that time, you know, Jim Dolan was a little bit desperate to turn, public sentiment in his favor because, you know, he had kind of killed that trade for Kyle Lowry, and people felt that, you know, Jim Dolan was too involved. So he went out and got Phil Jackson. I don't think in his heart of hearts Phil Jackson wanted that job. And I still go back to that press conference, Mike, because you remember what it was. It was all about Phil Jackson's connection with those great Knicks teams and Phil Jackson's connection to New York and being kind of a free spirit and his connection, of course, to Red Holtzman, and that's what brought him back. Yeah, that and about $12 million a year. You know, your tie to the organization wasn't that strong where you were going to come for $3 million. You'd only come if it was about $12 million a year.
He's the highest paid sports executive in the history of New York City. And again, he's 74 games under 500. And Frank, please remind people that it wasn't just Dolan. That in a way, Dolan and Jackson got played by a guy named Irving Azoff of the Eagles, who parlayed the Jackson thing into being a very big deal at Madison Square Garden in entertainment.
Yeah, Irving Azoff is a pretty fascinating character. If anybody got a chance to see the history of the Eagles, I'm talking about the rock band, of course. It's a really interesting documentary. You know, the late Glenn Frey, who was at Phil Jackson's press conference in New York, obviously he's tremendous in it, Don Henley. But Irving Azoff, you really get a sense of what he's like. He was the manager of the Eagles, and he's obviously a very intelligent guy. He's a mover and a shaker. He was an L.A. guy. He's the one that had the relationship with Phil. He's the one that hooked Phil and Jim Dolan up. And I think, you know, he's become a very prominent player in this whole thing. He helped Phil get that incredible deal. And Irving Azoff, you know, he yields a lot of power around Madison Square Garden. Like, you don't really see him anymore. You don't see him at a lot of games. But he and Jim Dolan are in business. They've become very good friends because we know that Jim Dolan, you know, he's big into music. That's great for him. And he loves that kind of the entertainment side of it as well. But Irving Azoff is kind of one of these, it's almost like he's running a bit of a shadow government around Madison Square Garden. He's like a major player that nobody really talks about, nobody really sees, but he is a big time player with the Knicks and the guard.
And by the way, Frank, you know, as mean as you can be sometimes, how much have you been punished across the years because they tried to get at me through you?
And that was the ridiculous part. And listen, do I like you? Yes. Do I work with you? Yes. So people are going to say, well, you're just saying that. But this is the truth. You've always been very fair to the New York Knicks. I know you love basketball. And do I think you go to bed every night praying that the Knicks win? No. But I think you enjoyed it when they had those great teams. And there's nothing that you like more than being at a great playoff game where the Knicks had a win and the Garden was into it and something magical happened. I could see that's when your juices get flowing. That's when you're at your best and you enjoyed it. And I think all you were doing, here's the weird thing, Mike, all you were doing was writing the truth. And, you know, if you go back and read your columns from 10 years ago, you know, 15 years ago, it's telling us exactly what's happening and what's going to happen. You knew that there was a shift in the culture, that things were not heading the right way. We don't want to write things that are going to upset people. We don't want to write things that make people feel bad, but we have an obligation to write what's going on, and it hasn't always been easy. But I think, you know, you've done that, and I followed your lead. All we have is the truth. I mean, I'm not going out there. I don't really have to dig up too many crazy things because it's the truth is stranger than fiction. There have been so many wacky things that have gone on that they've created, and we're just the people that are there writing about it, giving our opinion about it. And, Mike, here's the thing. I mean, I hate to say this. Have we been wrong about them?
No, Frank. And listen, we do want them to win. If I didn't want the Knicks to get better, I would have lobbied my friend of 40 years, Larry Brown, against taking that job. And I actually thought he could make it. You know all the maneuvering behind the scenes, and you know, and Isaiah sneaking out to the Hamptons, and the it'll be either in your book someday or my book. Okay,
let me just say this real quickly about that, about the Knicks wanting to do well. You hate the Knicks. I was the one telling them to hire Tom Thibodeau. Well, right. That's your friend. I know Tom. Well, what do you think? Tom's going to have me in his office before and after every game telling me what's going on? My relationship with him would take a major nosedive once he became a Knicks coach, because I know the way Tom is. He's going to have a bunker mentality, and he's going to go to work every day. I was the one suggesting that they hire him. He would have been a total lunatic. He would have thrown his entire being into the job, which is what the Knicks needed. That's why, you don't like the Knicks. If I don't like the Knicks, why would I tell you to hire Tom Thibodeau? Explain that one to me.
If I didn't want the Knicks to do well, and you know this, I've written this, we've talked about this. One of my best friends and one of my writing heroes is Pete Hamble. And he has always said Madison Square Garden is supposed to be one of the main plazas of New York City. Okay.
Yep.
And I had Jeff Van Gundy on this podcast a few weeks ago. And Frankie, we talk about this all the time, and so do you. We didn't know how good we had it in the 1990s. We thought we knew how good we had it when the Knicks were the hottest ticket in town. Joe Torre's Yankees were the biggest team in sports in that point. And guess what? We didn't feel in New York that the Yankee season really started until the Knicks stopped playing. Okay?
No.
So we want them to do well because we know the possibilities. But Frank, you laugh and I laugh. When they call it the Mecca now, the Mecca of what? The Mecca of what?
And it's funny you say that, because if you go back to those times, and like I said, I still think, on a lot of levels, we were more critical of the team because we were basing it really on championship or bust. And yet, look at the relationships we have, whether it's Patrick Ewing, whether it's Jeff Van Gundy, Charles Oakley,
Dave Checkets,
Derek Harper,
Doc Rivers,
Dave Checkets, Ernie Grunfeld. Listen, everything we wrote, they weren't going to send you a card thanking you for how nice you were. You know, sometimes there was some, hard, edgy things written about them as well, but they kind of understood that this is part of it, and yet we have great relationships with those guys, and that was at a time, here we go again, when the team was winning. And I think when you're winning, everything A is going to look better, and I think what the Knicks have tried to do really over these past 15 years is kind of justify the losing as, well, that's just the media. You know, they're kind of out to get us. They always have a negative slant on everything. That's really not the case. And you and I ran all those playoff games, whether it was Indiana, the Miami Heat, the Chicago Bulls, it was a great time. And, you know, I guess looking back at it now, we should have realized maybe it was a bit of a golden era. And I still remember in 2000 being in the locker room after game 6 when they lost to Indiana and the Pacers. Yep. You know, congratulations to them. They made it to a final. They had been through a lot as well. And when I walked into that locker room, and there was Patrick Ewing with that ugly blue robe that he used to wear. He had both, legs in a bucket of ice. And he had that look on his face where you knew it was kind of over, that he probably didn't want to be here anymore. And I really felt bad for him, because I felt like he always was the guy that put a lot on his shoulders. He never would throw his teammates under the bus. He wouldn't throw his coach under the bus. He was sacrificing minutes, shots, and yet he was still getting all the blame when they didn't win. I still remember that scene. And I'll tell you what, it was one of the saddest scenes, but it was kind of like, for me, it was an amazing moment, because I knew, you know, having watched Patrick as a player at Georgetown, and, you know, it was an honor to get a chance to cover him. Those were great years that we had there. When I think about being around the team and around the organization, I got to be honest with you, I think about those times, the late 90s into, you know, obviously 2000, 2001.
More with Frank Isola after this from Barracuda.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
You know, we're talking to Frank Isola, my pal from the New York Daily News and ESPN. Frankie, you know, I wrote a column about how Patrick, you know, we go over this all the time, how Patrick has put in his time, okay? And Jeff Van Gundy's right. No top 50 all-time player has ever spent as much time in training to be a head coach as Patrick Ewing has. Do you believe, we'll get back to the Knicks in a minute. Do you believe, as Jeff does, that there might be a bias against big men and head coaches in the NBA?
I think there might be. And, you know, think about who he's worked for. He started out in Washington under Doug Collins. He went to Houston with Jeff, Orlando with Stan Van Gundy, and now he's been for a while with Steve Clifford over in Charlotte. And I think it just amazes me. It's good that he's getting interviewed, which is important. You know, maybe, I mean, I hate to say this because I love Steve Clifford. Is there going to have to be a situation where he's named as an interim coach somewhere? I hope that's not the case. You know, I was doing research for a documentary where I had to interview Patrick Ewing. I mean, I got sent all this stuff, and I was reading, you know, a lot of stuff when he was growing up and he was in Cambridge. And, you know, when he had committed to Georgetown and was this whole thing, you know, people holding up these signs, Patrick can't read this. And that became like a big thing. And to the point where there was at a Big East tournament one year, the athletic director, it was either the AD of Georgetown or the president, had to basically, at a press conference, you know, had to confirm that Patrick was matriculating through Georgetown. It was amazing, like, how, like, mean-spirited a lot of this stuff was. But when it comes to coaching, it's almost like Patrick can't read this has been now been replaced by Patrick can't coach. And it really bothers me. I think he deserves a shot. That's not to say that the Knicks have to give him a head coaching job. You guys could not have interviewed him last year. That's asking too much for an iconic player like that that gave his heart and soul to the team, that's put in his time. He doesn't want some ceremonial job. He's not asking for a handout. But you guys just could not give him an interview. And that part of it really bothers me. I think he deserves a little bit more. Not saying you have to hand him a job. Can you just give him an interview?
He's 100 times more qualified to be a head coach in the NBA than Willis Reed was when the Knicks made him coach in the 1970s.
What about Derek Fisher? I get it. Derek is, and I thought, you know, Derek was trying to do things the right way. And I get it. Derek is friendly with Phil Jackson, but Derek went from playing right to getting a head coaching job. And sometimes it works out. Hey, worked out for Jason Kidd, Doc Rivers, TV, obviously won a championship. Patrick still put in the time. To me, at the very least, Mike, he's proven that he's going to put in the work. He loves the game of basketball. He's been around great coaches his entire life, whether it's John Thompson, Pat Riley, Chuck Daly on the Olympic team, Jeff Van Gundy. He's been around coaches everywhere, you know, his entire life. I just cannot believe that more teams just bring him in for an interview. Sit down and talk to him. And the Knicks should have done that.
You know, it's funny. I have two great Patrick Ewing stories. One involves John Thompson. And John and I had a, to put it mildly, a prickly relationship during his glory years at Georgetown, because I thought he was doing guys like Patrick a disservice by making them as suspicious of the media as he did. And one night, we're standing I was standing on the floor at the Garden, which before the game, which, remember, Frankie, when you could do that, when you could talk to people,
right,
when you didn't have people following you around to see if you were talking to somebody. And I'm standing there, and Big John comes over and he says, "Can I talk to you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, I've been thinking about something." He said, "We have two things in common." He said, "One doesn't matter, one does." I said, "Well, what are those?" He says, "We both love mystery novels." And he said, "You even wrote mystery?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "But the bigger thing is we both love Patrick Ewing." And I said, "Yes, we do." And John Thompson said, "To me, that's a good enough basis for a friendship." And he and I have been friends ever since, because I make no apologies about loving Patrick Ewing. I love his heart. People, again, when I say we didn't know how good we had it, Frankie, in the 90s, Knicks fans didn't know how good they had it with Patrick Ewing on those aching knees carrying them through season after season.
No, you know, he had so much pride. And, you know, Jeff has said this a million times. He didn't win a championship, but he always carried himself like a champion. And, you know, he's such a loyal guy. And just reading on some of this stuff, like I told you about, when I did a lot of research on him, you know, when he went to Georgetown, he, you know, John Thompson came to Cambridge and he spoke to Patrick's mother, and she said, "I want him to graduate. I want him to go to, if he's going to go to Georgetown, I want him to graduate." And after Patrick's freshman year, obviously they go to the national championship. Patrick has the, you know, all those goaltends at the beginning of the game against North Carolina, which ends, of course, with the famous Michael Jordan shot and then the famous or infamous Fred Brown turnover. But after that first season, John Thompson visits Patrick's mom in Cambridge and says, I just want you to know that if your son were to enter the NBA draft, he will be a first-round pick, and he would probably get X amount of dollars. You know, I mean, back then, it wasn't really what it is today, obviously. And she got really mad. She said, sir, I told you that he's graduating from Georgetown. Please do not talk about the NBA draft. He said, well, I just felt an obligation. She said, I appreciate that, but don't say any more. He's going to be there for 4 years. And I think Patrick is always – I'm sure a lot of that comes from his mother. Patrick has always been a very loyal guy. And over the years – you know, I've become like, you know, I mean, I don't have to, you know, you've known him a lot longer than I have. But whenever I see him, you know, we always share a laugh and I'll always slip in because he doesn't ever want to get too sentimental with you. But I'll always slip in something about how much I appreciated, like what he meant to the Knicks and what it was like covering him. You got to slip that in because he doesn't want to get too sentimental with you because he doesn't want you to know that he really does like you. But, you know, it was a great time when he was there.
You know, I'll tell you something. I was on the phone with him for about 45 minutes other day, and we talked about everything. But here's the other funny story, and I don't know if I ever told you this story. Remember the time, it was about a year and a half ago, when it was falsely reported for about 24 hours I was leaving the Daily News, and yep. The people in charge knew it wasn't true. My editors knew it wasn't true. It was simply negotiating a new contract. But as I told my wife Taylor that day and the kids, it's my turn in the barrel. This won't last. And it didn't, okay? But that night, when Politico, CNN, they're all saying that I was gone. Okay, people are writing my journalistic obituary, and by the way, Frankie, if I'd gotten fired that day, I probably wouldn't have made the Hall of Fame. Anyway, so Frankie, the phone rings about 9 o'clock, and the whole world's been calling me all day, and I think it's over. Okay, the phone rings at 9 o'clock, and I hear the following: now I'll never get a head coaching job in the NBA. it's Patrick. And I said, no, relax. I still have a job. And he goes, thank God.
That is great. And you know the way Patrick was too. Everyone used to mock him with the guaranteeing a victory. He would say, I'll see you Sunday. Like what did you expect him to say? He wasn't about like giving you the big quote, but he always knew when to say something and what it would mean. And I'll never forget in 1999, when the stuff was coming out about Phil Jackson, that maybe Phil Jackson will take over the Knicks. Now, the Knicks had already won their first-round series, so kind of the Phil Jackson stuff was dying down a little bit. But it was after, I think, Game 3 against the Atlanta Hawks, and I waited after Patrick had already taken a shower. So when he comes back from taking a shower, he would always be good. He'd wait for the media. He'd do his, like, you know, one deal, and then you could kind of have a conversation with him. But I waited by his locker. And I asked him, I said, you heard this stuff about Phil Jackson, right? And he just like looks at me. He's like, I'm not saying anything. I go, yeah, but he might, you know, what about that they might be talking to him? And he looks at me, he goes, you could print this. Tell Phil Jackson to take his ass back to Chicago. Which basically was, leave our team alone. Jeff Van Gundy's my guy. We'll be all right. And you know that that's not, Charles Barkley says that, you're going to laugh a little bit because it's Charles. If it's Reggie Miller, you know, you're used to that. But Patrick Ewing to say something like that, I was like floored when he said it. And I will say this, Mike, it made for a pretty good story.
It did, Frankie, but it's not the first and it's not the last that you'll get. Let's circle back to the current Knicks situation. Do you think Jeff Hornacek will be the coach next year?
You know what? I can't say that is definitely going to happen. You know, Phil only gave Derek Fisher, who was one of his guys, who helped him win championships, kind of keep that locker room in L.A. together. He gave him a year and a half. And, you know, so he doesn't have that relationship with Hornacek, and it's weird. Hornacek tried to get away from running the triangle in training camp. They returned after the All-Star break, and it was like, you know, relearning the triangle. So I don't know how that's all going to play out. If I'm a betting man, maybe not. Maybe he's not going to be there. Maybe he doesn't want to be there with the way things are shaking out. I think if you look at the last 17 years, I would say, considering what they thought they might have, the moves that they've made, I think this might be the worst or the second worst year that they've had in the last 17. This has been a major, major disappointment. I don't want to hear about another rebuild and all this other stuff. Everyone thought that Phil Jackson would get it right by now, and he hasn't. The deal for Noah has not worked out. Now, Derrick Rose has actually you know, held up and, you know, take away the AWOL and the fact that he won't play defense or shoot three-pointers. But, you know, he's proven that he still has a little something left. But the bottom line is they're going to be a lottery team. They're expecting more. I mean, they're basically out of it. And, you know, they were out of it basically by the All-Star break. And I think people expected a lot more out of this team.
Frank, we know how much Dolan likes it when anybody except him is being blamed for the failures of the New York Knicks. We have seen that repeatedly over the years. So not only did Phil Jackson provide cover, he provided cover in the form of a 6'8", former coach, 11-time winner, one of the iconic coaches or managers, okay? But when does that get old at the Garden? When does Dolan realize that if he keeps this guy around and this team stays on its present path, it's on him now for allowing this guy to have two or three or however many more years like the last three we've witnessed?
And I think a big part of it is going to be Porzingis. And I think Porzingis this season, you know, I don't think he's progressed the way that they hoped that he would. To me, his body language hasn't been great. I think he's been a bit beaten down with all the nonsense that has gone on. And I also think Phil Jackson kind of going after Carmelo Anthony in the media. And maybe you're one of, you know, you'll have fans out there, well, he deserves it. And, you know, they should say that about Carmelo. Just think about how that plays in the locker room. Because the players in the locker room respect Carmelo Anthony. And they're thinking, well, if the president of the team is going after him like that, what must he be saying about me? And what might he say about me publicly? And I think that's hurt him. And I think Jim Dolan, on the one hand, has wanted to prove to everybody, I could be hands-off. Now, to me, he hasn't been hands-off about everything. I think he got involved in the Steve Kerr negotiations. I also think he got involved in Carmelo Anthony negotiations. I think he got involved in not kind of, you know, making it pretty clear that he didn't want Kurt Rambis to be the head coach. But for the most part, he has stayed out of it. But that shouldn't be good enough for Knicks fans. This has been going on too long now where it just hasn't been good. This was a team that won 54 games not that long ago. Look at what they've done since then. They're not anywhere close to being that team anymore. And the guy that made the big moves was Jim Dolan. He's the one that got rid of Glenn Grunwald. He brought in Phil Jackson, and Phil got rid of Mike Woodson. So the one little morsel of success that the Knicks have had, Jim Dolan and Phil Jackson removed it. And I think there's going to come a point, and I think you're hitting on it, where, you know, I think the fans are going to start looking at Jim Dolan and say, what is the deal here? Phil Jackson can't turn this around.
You know, Frankie, you look at what's happened with the Knicks. You look at what's happened with Phil Jackson, okay? How boneheaded was it of him to get rid of Mike Woodson? Why couldn't Mike Woodson stay? Because he wasn't Phil's guy? Guess what? Phil has no guys, Frank. You look at Larry Brown's extended coaching tree and the careers he's touched, okay? From Calipari to Bill Self to Pop to, you know, to Mark, go on and on and on. It is one of the most amazing coaching trees in the history of basketball. Phil's coaching tree, Frankie, looks like a tree in the winter with no leaves.
Well, that happens to be truthful, because I think a lot of his guys, he do not have great records. And I think when he came in there, you know, he should have had a better read on what was going to happen with Steve Kerr before he got rid of Mike Woodson. Because once he got rid of Mike Woodson, now you know that you're hiring a coach. And I really feel that once Kerr didn't take the job, I don't think Phil had a plan B. And I think he called up Kurt Rambis, and I think Rambis thought that he was getting the job. But I think Phil thought, you know what, I can't sell my first hire on being Kurt Rambis. Maybe a guy like Derek Fisher, who's coming, you know, has those leadership qualities. He's a young guy. People know who he is. I'll use Kurt as his mentor. And I think, you know, I don't think enough people really look back at, you know, how much he blew that one. Because if you were going to get rid of Mike Woodson, who had success and was getting through to guys like Carmelo Anthony, we talk all the time about accountability. Remember Mike Woodson told Carmelo, you need to get in better shape. Carmelo got in better shape. They were a 54-win team. And Mike Woodson had a lot to do with Rasheed Wallace coming out of retirement. And Rasheed Wallace, by the time the Knicks got him, barely could play a lick. But he had something to do in that locker room, kind of keeping everything in order. Same thing with Jason Kidd. They hit on something that year that people talk about all the time. You know, I don't know team chemistry. I don't know. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And that team certainly had it. They were really connected. I think Mike Woodson deserves a lot of credit. J.R. Smith was the sixth man of the year. Carmelo finished third in the MVP voting. They should have beaten Indiana that year. I think blowing that game five at home against Boston, having to play the game six on a Friday, and then turning around and playing game one on that Sunday afternoon, I think that quick turnaround hurt that team because they had a bunch of older players that needed the extra days to rest. I think that's really where that series turned because they were better. Miami was a better team, but they had beaten Miami during the regular season.
They beat them three times they beat them three times during the regular season. And what people forget about the Boston series, not only did they have to play an extra game and JR through the elbow, all that stuff, they nearly lost the game in Boston on Friday night. Remember, they were up by a million points, and Avery Bradley went crazy, and they had to end up playing a life-and-death game in Boston.
Yeah, and then they went up Sunday to the Garden, game one, which I think it was like a 2 o'clock game or a 3 o'clock game. I remember DJ Augustine came off the bench for Indiana, had a huge game, and the Knicks never played with a lead in that series. Yes, they won game two, but then they lost game three and four, and that it basically was it. You could tell that they were running out of steam, and that team had kind of had it. And I still go back to them losing. To me, their worst moment of that entire season was at Game 5. They needed to close out Boston on that. I guess it was a Wednesday night. They lose the game. They had to go up to Boston on that Friday. Losing that Game 5 set them up for the rest of the season to lose that Indiana series.
Let me circle back to something you said about Porzingis, because I meant to ask you about it earlier in this podcast. Again, it's a Mike Lubega podcast. We're talking to my pal, Frank Isola. Again, download this podcast. It grows every single week. It's gotten stupidly popular. Subscribe to it and go to the comment section. I know you won't want to say anything mean about me, but if you want to say mean things about Frankie, have at it. Okay, Porzingis. Frank, to me, he has taken a step back this year, and I think part of it is the confusion of Hornacek wanting to play one way and Jackson wanting them to play another way. And I'll tell you something else. Larry Brown is right. You ought to play him at center and play Carmelo at power forward.
No, that would be their best lineup. And listen, they're going to do some growing pains there, but they should have done this from the start. Phil Jackson should have had the foresight to know that with Kyle O'Quinn, the guy, Willie Hernan Gomez coming in, maybe we'll be covered in the center department and with Porzingis starting. And if we do need somebody, we'll go out and we'll bring in a veteran player. To invest that much money in Joakim Noah, who had played 27 games the year before and had a history now of injury problems, was a big mistake that they made. And I don't think they have focused enough on Kristaps Porzingis. So the other night, I'm watching the Knicks in Milwaukee. I'm at the game, and I'm watching Giannis Antetokounmpo. This is a guy who's 22 years old, and the Bucks are making it all about Antetokounmpo. And this is a guy that started the All-Star game. He is a phenomenal player. He's played more years in the NBA than Porzingis. I get that. But he's certainly much further along in his development. And they are both, like I said, 22 years old. So I think the Knicks, it should be further along with Porzingis than it is right now. And that really would be a disaster if this doesn't progress for him and he doesn't get better. Because I will say it, he is not happy with what's going on in New York. I really think this year, last year was great. He was the unicorn, burst onto the scene. Everyone's falling in love with him. And I think this year, it's really hit him like a ton of bricks, that it's going to be a lot harder, and that this organization has some issues that they really need to iron out.
All right, a couple more questions for my pal, Frank Isola. Talk about the night that you went to a Knicks game and ended up at a police station, Frankie.
Yeah, it's really one of the more surreal moments, and it wasn't good for anybody involved. And, we all love Charles Oakley, and we know what, Charles is about. He could be just like Dolan. He could be, insensitive, could be a bully at times. I thought what happened that night was disgraceful, though. And to drag him out of the building and just that image of that, especially in these times that we live, I just thought it was a bad look for everyone involved, the NBA, the Knicks, Charles, and especially, Jim Dolan and Madison Square Garden. It was, and we have been there for a lot of surreal things. The Denver Nugget fight with the Knicks when Carmelo was on Denver, how wacky that thing happened. Marcus Camby and Danny Ferry getting into a fight.
Obviously, Jeff holding on to Alonzo's leg.
But this one, top it all. I mean, it was just a shocking thing to see. And there I was standing outside, Midtown South. Thankfully, it was a warm February night, so it wasn't that bad. But it was strange. It was sad. And I really felt for a minute, I kind of felt like people kind of got a sense of, like, if the Knicks don't like you, if you're a current employee, former employee, former player, former coach, or a media member, that's kind of like the treatment you get. You're kind of being dragged out of the building, you know, symbolically in some way. And I just saw it. How could Adam Silver, who's done such a great job at the NBA, how could he not have been saddened by the whole thing, upset, really disappointed? Because the NBA is better than that. And that never should have happened.
All right. Would anybody who isn't named Phil Jackson still have this job running the New York Knicks?
No way. No way. I mean, he's falling back on those 11 rings. And, you know, when we talked about his press conference, when he talked about transparency, open relationship with the media, trying to build a culture, he hasn't done any of that stuff. I just don't think he has the willpower, the energy to get the job done. It is a all-encompassing job. Like I said, you know, Bob Myers is a young guy traveling all over the place. R.C. Buford, who, Mike, most NBA people, most basketball fans wouldn't know him if they tripped over him. He's just a guy that goes to work every day. When is there ever a Pat Riley signing? That's because Pat Riley's working behind the scenes. That's what the Knicks need Phil Jackson to do. They don't need him on the court teaching players an offense that nobody else in the NBA plays and an offense that his own players don't want to play.
Will he walk away, or is there any chance that he is not back for year four? I don't believe he walks away from this money. Is there any room for Dolan to fire him?
I don't see it happening. I just don't. I definitely don't see him walking away. Why should I walk away? I'm making a ton of money. Obviously, wins and losses don't care. It's not like I'm working my fingers to the bone. Why should he walk away? He's certainly not suffering from exhaustion. I will tell you that. It really has been a mess. I thought it would be a lot better. I thought at the very least, Phil would come in and make the Knicks, you know, it'd be like he'd create like a culture. There would be accountability, but there has not been any of that.
James Dolan and the Buss family, I mean, he sure can pick owners, can he, Frankie?
Tell you what, he's made a lot of money off of both of them, that's for sure.
Frankie, you were awesome today. Not only do I like working with you, you know how much I love reading you, and I love the toughness you've shown on this beat. Thank you for doing this today, pal.
Well, Mike, you've been a great mentor, and say hello to your family. Your boys always crack me up whenever I talk to them, so say hello to everybody for me, okay?
Frankie, thank you again, pal.
Thanks.
That is Frank Isola. And again, he has become such a major media figure in New York City because the savvy sports fans know what he's gone through. Knicks fans, this is your tutorial on everything that is happening, has happened, and is going to happen to this franchise. This is the kind of conversation we have every single week. Again, if you want to know the real deal with the Knicks, all you have to do is read Frank Isola. Talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.